I've seen photos of the waffle stomper boot impressions you left in the dirt beneath a teenage girl's bedroom on July 17, 1976, in Carmichael. A crude relic from a time when voyeurs had no choice but to physically plant themselves in front of windows. You excelled at the stealth siddle, but your heyday prowess has no value anymore. Your skill set has been phased out. The tables have been turned. Virtual windows are opening all around you. You, the Master Watcher, are an aging, lumbering target in their crosshairs. A ski mask won't help you now. One victim's phone rang 24 years after her rape. "You want to play?" a man whispered. It was you. She was certain. You played nostalgic, like an arthritic former football star running game tape on a VCR. "Remember when we played?" I imagine you dialing her number, alone in a small, dark room, sitting on the edge of your twin bed. The only weapon left in your arsenal, firing up a memory, the ability to trigger terror with your voice. One day soon, you'll hear a car pull up to your curb, an engine cut out. You'll hear footsteps coming up your front walk, like they did for Edward Wayne Edwards. 29 years after he killed Timothy Hack and Kelly Drew in Sullivan, Wisconsin. Like they did for Kenneth Lee Hicks, 30 years after he killed Lori Billingsley in Aloha, Oregon. The doorbell rings. No side gates are left open. You're long past leaping over a fence. Take one of your hyper-gulping breaths. Clench your teeth. Inch timidly toward the insistent bell. This is how it ends for you. You'll be silent forever, and I'll be gone in the dark. You threatened a victim once. Open the door. Show us your face. Walk into the light. Hello, Chroma homies, and I'm your host, Bailey Camp, and welcome to part two of the Golden State Killer case. Now, what you just heard was an excerpt from Michelle McNamara's book, I'll Be Gone in the Dark, and it's The Letter to an Old Man. And I really just wanted to read part of it to you because I think it is so powerful, and she kind of perfectly predicted what would happen to him. And so I thought the best way to kick off the episode where we talk about how he was ultimately caught was to, you know, read this, and it kind of lays out exactly what happened. So for those of you who don't know the case, I would highly recommend you go back and listen to part one, because this episode is doing a deep dive into the process of catching the vile human now known as Joseph James DeAngelo. So for this episode, I'm actually not going to ask you to travel back to the 1970s or 1980s with me. Wild, I know. We will actually be going back to the year 1994, which was the year that Tonya Harding's bodyguard attacked Nancy Kerrigan and that the OJ Bronco chase occurred. It was also the year that Mr. Paul Holes began working on the East Area Rapist cold case as a criminalist in Contra Costa County. Paul actually stumbled across this case. He was just looking through a filing cabinet with old evidence, and he found files labeled with the letters EAR. When he asked a colleague about it, the colleague told him about the East Area Rapist and the heinous crimes he had committed from 1976 to 1979. It should be noted that it was pretty incredible that the crime lab still had this evidence, because the statute of limitations for rape was not very long at the time. It was around 3 to 6 years, and it was common to throw out evidence if crimes had passed the statute of limitations. If a crime is committed but enough time has passed so it is considered past the statute of limitations, then the person cannot be prosecuted for that crime, even if they identify the perpetrator. When Paul started working on the East Area Rapist cold case, he knew that the offender couldn't be prosecuted, but he wanted to see if he could give the offender a name. In order to get more information on this case, Paul Holes called Detective Larry Crompton, who worked on the East Area Rapes in Contra Costa County. Detective Crompton actually wrote a book about the East Area Rapes called Sudden Terror, and I would very much recommend that if you want to take a deeper dive into this case, you read it. When the two men spoke, Larry told Paul that he knew of 5 murders in Southern California that he highly suspected were done by the East Area Rapists, but no one in that jurisdiction would talk to or listen to him. Larry actually told Paul to call the Santa Barbara Police Department to see what he could find out. Paul did reach out to Santa Barbara, but he was shut down. The person he spoke to from Santa Barbara told him to contact Irvine, which ultimately led him to Orange County and criminalist Mary Huang. Mary Huang was a part of the countrywide law enforcement unsolved element, or CLUE, and she performed DNA profiling from samples from the Harrington, Whitehune, Cruz, and Smith murders, and actually connected them through DNA profiling. After performing the profiling, she sent the profiles to crime labs throughout the country, trying to find other crimes committed by the same person and hopefully learn his identity. When Paul contacted Mary, he actually discovered that the DNA technology in his crime lab in Contra Costa County was not as advanced as the technology in the Orange County crime lab. So they would have to wait until the Contra Costa lab upgraded their technology to compare the samples from the East Area Rapes and the original Night Stalker murders. In 1997, Contra Costa County's crime lab was not CODIS eligible yet, meaning they could not link into the state or national databases. 1997 was actually the year that the FBI announced the selection of the 13 STR or microsatellite loci that would be analyzed to form genetic profiles, which we talked about in the Janie Landers case. So I'm actually re-recording this part of the episode because before I just knew that the technology between the two labs didn't produce profiles that could be compared and determine if it was 100% the same person. So I actually decided to try and reach out to Paul Holes to see if he could give me any sort of clarification, and sure enough, he actually emailed me back today. So after fangirling a little bit and then going back and doing more research, I can actually explain exactly why they weren't able to definitively link the cases before 2001. Okay, so in the early 1990s, PCR was becoming all the rage in forensics and in science in general. A particular method was using PCR-based dot plot with DQA1 and polymarker. And if that sounded like gibberish to you, you are not alone. I actually went and read a forensics textbook to figure it out, so I'll walk you through it. Basic PCR amplification is where you take double-stranded DNA, you separate the two strands, and you use these things called primers that will target specific strands in the DNA that are before the sequence you want to copy, and they will attach to the strand before that sequence. And then you'll use an enzyme called TAC polymerase, which will then use that primer as a starting point, and then it will make a complementary copy of your target sequence. Once you have gone through those three steps, split apart the DNA strands or denaturization, attaching of the primers, and the copying or synthesis of a new strand, then you will have double the amount of copies of the DNA sequence that you started with. PCR basically just amplifies the sequence until you have lots and lots of copies of it. Now, using PCR-based dot plot with DQA1 and polymarker, you will do the PCR amplification, and then you will have these membranes, which are these little sheets with a single-stranded oligonucleotide probe attached in circles or dots. And these probes are just designed to attach to specific DNA sequences. So they'll only attach to what their sequence is complementary to. They won't attach to anything else. So they're used to kind of discriminate between sequences. Each dot is designed to attach to a different allele or alternative form of DNA at a specific location. So this would be like if you had an adenine base at a particular location in the DNA in one person, and then another person, they had a thymine base at that exact same location in their DNA. Sites that can have these different forms or alleles in different people are said to be polymorphic. To classify as a polymorphism, each allele at that site has to be present in 1% or more of the population. Okay, so we have these dots that are only supposed to link or attached to particular alleles based on the sequence of the probe. PCR dot plot with DQA1 and polymarker determines which alleles individuals have at six different locations in the genome. It's looking at DQA1, which is an HLA type gene, LDLR, GYPA, HBGG, D7S8, and GC. And based on the combinations of alleles an individual has at these six sites, we can build profiles. Now, these are different than SCR profiles, which we talked about in the Janie Landers case. PCR amplification started to be used to identify STR profiles after PCR-based dot plot. But instead of allowing the PCR product to attach the dots to see what alleles are present, you use them to run an electrophoresis, which is basically a method of separating DNA sequences by length, and then use a stain to determine which bands are present. Bands at different locations on the gel electrophoresis indicate DNA sequences of different sizes and thus different alleles. Now, the reason that this works with microsatellites / STRs is that STRs differ in the number of repeats, so the different alleles take the form of varying lengths of repeating DNA. One of the first ever PCR with silver stain analysis was CTT triplex system, which looked at STRs CSF1PO, TPOX, and TH01. All three of these STR loci are part of the 13 loci used today for STR genetic profiling. However, they have the least amount of variation of the current markers. Each STR allele will be shared by between 5 and 20% of individuals. However, when comparing the combination of STR alleles each individual has, there's about a 1 in a trillion chance that they will have the same combination unless they are identical twins. So the reason I'm telling you all of this is because the Contra Costa County Crime Lab, try saying that five times fast, was using PCR-based dot plot with DQA1 and polymarker at that time. And the Orange County Crime Lab was using STR system with CTT, which means they were not looking at the same locations in the genome. Now, Paul did say that they both had the DQA1 type, so they knew that both their samples shared those alleles, because each person has two copies of a gene. But you could only distinguish between 28 alleles at that one location with that testing. So if there are only 28 different alleles, even though people have two copies of each gene, that's still a limited number of different alleles to have at those locations. So there just wasn't enough variation at this one location to definitively distinguish between a bunch of people and say it's only one person. It can narrow it down to a subset of people, but without looking at multiple other sites as well, they just couldn't narrow it down to that one person. They had too many options. So unfortunately, they would have to wait until the Contra Costa County Crime Lab started using STR testing is basically the answer. And I just want to do a big shout out to Paul because I really wasn't expecting an answer. A small podcast, and I'm a graduate student who does this in my free time. So I thought that was really cool, and I really appreciate it because it did change my episode a little bit, and it allowed me to share new information with you guys. So I'm just really thankful that he did answer, and I was able to kind of tell you guys about this. So Huang and Holes promised to keep in contact until Contra Costa County got their technology updated. And in 2001, Contra Costa County was CODIS eligible and they were able to make that comparison. Paul was then able to generate a more advanced profile and compare to the one Mary Huang had generated already. It was a match. Once they had a match, now the different departments could work together to share all the information and evidence they had on the perpetrator. The perpetrator's genetic profile was entered in CODIS in 2001. Although they now had this link and were sharing information, the Golden State Killer's identity would remain a mystery until 17 years later. During those 17 years, numerous people were working on this case, whether they were law enforcement or private citizens. Paul began working the GSK case again in 2011, 10 years after the DNA match was made. He read through all the files and identified suspects, witnesses, victims, crime scenes, and anything else to get a better understanding of the case. He would then go interview witnesses or talk to victims to get more information. anything that might help him narrow down the suspect list or add someone to it. It was a case he just couldn't let go. Paul would go through the evidence in the files and determine if there was enough for him to pursue getting a DNA sample from a suspect. If there was, he would put a team together and retrieve a DNA sample from something that the suspect discarded in a public place. Yes, you heard me right. If you throw something away in public, the police can take it and use it to test your DNA against a sample. Paul continued this process for 5 years. While Paul was working on the law enforcement DNA collection front, private citizens were also trying to solve this case. One that y'all who are familiar with the case might know is Michelle McNamara, whose book I have been talking about for the last two episodes. Michelle was an amazing writer who originally started in the true crime world with her blog True Crime Diary, where she would cover different cases. Michelle started writing about GSK in 2013 for LA Magazine and actually coined the name Golden State Killer, because before he had several different names, and GSK just kind of encompasses all of them. She worked with other citizens like Paul Haynes, who helped her research, retired investigators, and current investigators like Paul Foles. Michelle interviewed victims and went through all the case files she could get her hands on. Her articles and her book were largely responsible for making this case well known, because before she started covering it, it was not really talked about that much. Zodiac and Jack the Ripper seemed to be household names, but for some reason, the East Area Rapist slash Original Night Stalker wasn't. I mean, it could be partially due to the name, but still. The use of genetic genealogy was actually one of Michelle's interests, and she truly thought it could potentially be used to solve this case. Unfortunately, Michelle passed away in April of 2016, before she could witness the arrest of the Golden State Killer, which was largely due to forensic slash genetic genealogy. In 2016, Paul Holtz decided it was time to switch up his tactics. First, Paul tried using Y chromosome DNA, which is basically where you look at the DNA on the Y chromosome and use it to try to identify other biologically male family members. This only works with individuals who are born biologically male, because they are typically the ones who have a Y chromosome. Unfortunately, this did not yield great results, so Paul moved on to the next tactic. He wanted to try genetic genealogy. Forensic or genetic genealogy is the use of a DNA sample to obtain a person's raw data, which is basically their entire DNA sequence, and uploading it to an interpretation tool like GenMatch, where they will then identify individuals who share portions of a DNA with an individual. The more portions they share, the closer typically they are genetically related. I say typically because the amount of DNA shared varies on their relationship. For example, you typically share 50% of your DNA with each of your parents, children, and full siblings, and these are known as your first degree relatives. You share 25% with each of your grandparents, aunts, uncles, nephews, nieces, half-siblings, which are your second degree relatives. You share 12.5% with your first cousins, great-grandparents, or great-grandchildren, which are your third-degree relatives. So basically, with each degree, you share about half as much DNA as a previous degree. Before I continue the story, I also want to clarify the difference between direct-to-consumer testing companies like Ancestry and 23andMe, and interpretation tool websites like GenMatch and Prometheus. Direct-to-consumer testing companies sell kits to users so they can provide DNA samples that will then be used to provide some information about the user, whether it be ancestry, health information, traits, etc. They can also provide users with the raw data, which is their genetic sequence. Interpretation tool websites like GenMatch and Prometheus take an individual's raw data and then interpret it based off the purpose of the tool. GenMatch can use raw data to connect individuals to family members and allow individuals who did direct-to-consumer testing with different companies to connect. For example, if someone did testing through Ancestry and another person did testing through 23andMe, they would be able to upload their raw data to GenMatch and find family members that did testing through other companies. Prometheus uses the SNPedia wiki, which contains genes identified by research that affect medical traits, to inform people about health risk and can provide information about phenotypic traits like eye color. While Prometheus might be useful, if you do have a family history of a genetic condition or are showing signs or symptoms, I would strongly recommend seeing a genetic counselor, as they are specifically trained to analyze personal medical history and family history to determine if genetic testing is appropriate, and if so, what conditions to test for. The other thing I want to say is before you send your DNA to a company or put your information into a database, please read the fine print about how they use your DNA and if they're able to sell the information to third parties. Okay, that was my plug. Back to the program. At the time, Paul was trying to use genetic genealogy to identify the Golden State Killer. And even now, private companies like Ancestry, 23andMe, and MyHeritage are not allowing law enforcement to use their databases to solve crimes. These companies can potentially be subpoenaed, but at this point they have been unsuccessful. The two companies that allow law enforcement to use their databases are GEDmatch, which again does not actually do any testing itself, rather is a site for raw data being uploaded from previous testing, and FamilyTree DNA, which is a testing company. The current policy for GEDmatch is that the users are automatically opted out of letting law enforcement use their information, and users have to opt in. This is different from when Paul was trying to solve the case. FamilyTree DNA is the opposite in that users are automatically opted in, and they have to opt out if they don't want their information to be used by law enforcement. So Paul wanted to use genetic genealogy to try to identify GSK, and there were limited databases out there he could use to do so. He ultimately decided on GEDmatch. But before Paul could upload the raw data to GEDmatch, he first needed more DNA due to the fact that he had used up the samples doing previous testing. He reached out to other jurisdictions to try to find enough sample to obtain a profile. This was a challenge, partially because, again, most rape case evidence was thrown out once the statute of limitations was up. Luckily for Paul, when he spoke to the Ventura DA investigator, he was told that they had plenty of GSK sample. When Paul received some of the samples, he went to work. In early 2018, he received the GSK's raw data and uploaded it to GEDmatch. He actually got over 1,000 matches. Unfortunately, most of these matches were not close matches. The closest he got were third cousins, who share about 0.08% DNA with the person they matched with. Now that he had the matches, it was time to construct a family tree. Paul called genetic genealogist Barbara Ray Venter and asked if she would help on this case, and she readily agreed. Their first task was to take the matches and track back to the most recent common ancestor, which for third cousins would be likely a great-great-grandparent. To identify these common ancestors, Paul and Barbara would use sources outside of GEDmatch, such as social media and public records. Once they identified the most recent common ancestor, they did what is known as reverse genealogy, which is where you build the tree forward from that common ancestor. This can be painstaking and time-consuming depending on if the individual is in the database or not. Barbara also put the raw data through Prometheus, which reported that their killer would likely have blue eyes and be prematurely balding. As they constructed their tree, Paul and Barbara went to work identifying potential suspects among the family. They would look at things like date of birth, physical description, location, career, etc., to see if it was plausible for an individual to commit these crimes. Once they had identified suspects, they would follow up on leads, doing further investigation into the person's life. Paul would also obtain DNA samples on some of the suspects in order to compare to the GSK's profile. As they were narrowing down their suspect pool, Barbara came across an old newspaper article about a man who had been arrested in Citrus Heights for shoplifting dog repellent and a hammer. She asked Paul if this man had been ruled out, and he told her that he hadn't. This man was actually on the list of six people left from their genealogical search. This man had an ex-fiancée named Bonnie, had purchased a handgun outside of Visalia, and had a daughter born in LA County in 1986. His geographic connections made sense. He was also the only one of the six men left on the list with blue eyes. This man is Joseph James D'Angelo. Law enforcement made their arrest on April 24, 2018 in Citrus Heights after retrieving a piece of garbage from his trash can and comparing it to the GSK's genetic profile. It was a 100% match. Paul actually had retired about 3 weeks before D'Angelo was arrested, but he was at the press conference held the next day on April 25th, 2018, which ironically was National DNA Day. I want to play y'all a short clip from the press conference that gave me chills and just shows how momentous this arrest was.
Joseph James D'Angelo has been called a lot of things by law enforcement. He's been called the East Side Rapist. He's been called the Visalia Ransacker, the original Night Stalker, and the Golden State Killer. Today, it's our pleasure to call him defendant.
That was Tony Rakakis, DA of Orange County. I just thought that was incredibly powerful and wanted to share it. D'Angelo was not charged with the rapes or burglaries due to the expiration of the statute of limitations, but he was charged with 13 counts of murder and 13 counts of kidnapping. D'Angelo was arraigned on August 23, 2018. Many of his victims showed up at the arraignment so he could look at their faces. For those who couldn't be there, friends and family attended and held up pictures. His victims took back the power that day. On April 10, 2019, prosecutors announced that they would seek the death penalty. On March 4th, 2020, D'Angelo was offered a plea deal, which took the death penalty off the table, but he didn't take it. However, on June 29th, 2020, D'Angelo did take the deal and pled guilty to all 13 counts of first-degree murder and 13 counts of kidnapping. He also has admitted to many of the rapes. During his pre-sentencing hearing, the victims had the chance to come up and make their statements. They looked at him and told him how he invaded their homes and bodies, took away their sense of security, and terrorized them. On August 21st, 2020, D'Angelo was sentenced to multiple consecutive life sentences without the possibility of parole. 48 years after he began as the Visalia Ransacker, D'Angelo is now 75 and incarcerated at California State Prison, Corcoran, and he will die in prison. And that is the Golden State Killer case. Thanks to countless law enforcement members, private citizens, journalists, and so many others, justice has been served. I do have one note that doesn't tie directly to the case, but ties more to the use of direct-to-consumer testing. A study by Yanif Ehrlich finds that you would only need about 3 million people in one of the direct-to-consumer databases, like 23andMe, GEDmatch, or MyHeritage, in order for 99% of the white European population in the U.S. to be identifiable. While there are not currently 3 million people in either of the databases that law enforcement are able to access in some capacity, GEDmatch and Family Tree DNA, there are over 30 million people in Ancestry, 23andMe, MyHeritage, and Family Tree and DNA combined. This means if you are of white European descent, someone would likely be able to identify you from the information in one of these databases, even if you never provided a DNA sample or entered your information into their database. If your mom, dad, brother, grandparent, aunt, uncle, etc. entered their information, it can be used to identify you. I thought this just was important to mention because while police cannot use it, there are still some other privacy issues that could arise. Thank you all so much for listening. I'm seriously so appreciative to those who do listen to this podcast. Even though my enunciation is a little lax at times, I'm working on it, I promise. I will be posting more information on the breakdown of direct-to-consumer private companies versus interpretation tool websites and databases on our website, killingjeanspodcast.com. You can find all our sources in the show notes or on that website. You can also follow us on Instagram at Killing Jeans Podcast, on Twitter at Killing Jeans Pod, and on TikTok at Killing Jeans Podcast, where I actually started posting mini cases. I hope you all learned something today, or at least enjoyed this episode. And I hope you have a great week. Take care, y'all.